I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Money Matters with MeQ. Today, we're talking with Frank Sisla about starting a small business. Frank is a vice president of business services and also served as interim executive director of the Baltimore City Chamber of Commerce. So, Frank, welcome to the studio. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's just talk about this whole idea of starting a business. That's this American dream that everybody wants their own business.
Yeah, I think everyone's had the idea one time or another that, hey, I can make a better widget or do this a little bit better than most folks, and my dream is to make $1 million or, you know, be a millionaire by the time I'm 22. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more to it than that. I mean, there are some folks that hit it lucky, there's no doubt. But there's a lot of work and a lot of research that people should do before they start using their hard-earned capital and go down the wrong road.
That's an important point here, because being in charge of a business doesn't mean that you're going to end up being the wealthiest man on the block.
That's correct. You're going to be the hardest working man on the block,
or
perhaps.
Or woman.
Me, yes.
Right.
Yes. I mean, you are everything. If you're a sole proprietor, you're the boss, you're the go-to guy, you're the secretary, you do it all, because it is just you, and you got to work maybe 7 days a week, 24/7. I mean, it's not that critical, but you're on call. Let's put it that way.
Right, because when you own your own business, you're never away from it, because you always have to meet your own payroll. Payroll for take care of the people you work for, whatever that is, pay the mortgage, as well as paying the rent to your shop or whatever you're doing.
Correct. I mean, the added expenses outside of a home office can get pretty high. I mean, you have to take all those things into consideration before you start to actually start a business. And there's a lot of people out there that can help you. Maybe we can talk about that at some point.
Well, let's talk about what you would talk about if you were talking to somebody about the kind of research they'd have to do to make sure that what their dream is will actually work or has potential of working.
Well, I think market research, particularly for the area that you're going into, demographics, As someone said, how many people are going to walk by your shop? Well, where you guys are located, I had a hard time finding it. If I was doing this on foot traffic, I don't think I'd survive. But you need to be up on 36th Street. I mean, just as an example, you need to be on a main avenue, perhaps, which are going to pay a higher rent. So you just have to balance those kinds of things off.
So market research is important.
Yes, you need to know how many people are going to, if you're a retail shop particularly, how many people are going to pass by.
Do you do that yourself or have someone else do it for you?
Oh, you can do, there are several resources out there. One I'm going to get, I would mention, and it's a free service in general, but they do have some cost programs, Small Business Resource Center over the old Eastern High School on 33rd Street. Great program over there, and they're more than willing to help you with all that heavy-duty lifting stuff.
The Small Business Resource Center, we'll put that on the website for people to see. And so what about a business plan, and how do you do that? Because that sounds easy, but it's not that easy a process to develop a business plan and do it right.
No, there are set formats for business plans. There's several resources. Obviously, if you hit Google, and I think the other one's Dogpile, sometimes you can get a template, and it. But again, the Small Business Resource Center, I don't want to send it all to them, but I will tell you this. If you come to a financial institution empty-handed, say, I have a great idea, it's hard for the lender to understand that idea. He or she needs to be able to see it in writing, get some pictures, whatever it is, get some projections. It's critical. It's critical.
And so you're saying you should be, even before you step into a credit union bank, any lending institution, I mean, you get your research done first and go to this place that you were talking, the Small Business
Resource Center,
the old Eastern High School.
Correct. That's one of the resources. The other would be the SBA, group over there called SCORE. It used to be the Retired Executives. I don't know what it, but they that's another free service. So there's several of them out there.
Francis, this has really been interesting. So what we're going to do here is, folks, stay tuned. We are going to bring Frank back next week to finish this conversation about small businesses and how you want to get started. And on the website will be all the information you need to find the information we've been talking about. Frank Sisla, VP for Business Services, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. MeQ, invest in yourself, and we'll invest in you. For more information, call MeQ at 1-800-248-MECU or www.mecu.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Vatz, who's a Towson University professor, associate psychology editor at USA Today magazine.
I am indeed.
Huh?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anne McCarthy, who's Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And is Lester here yet? We'll be joined in a minute by Dr. Lester Spence, who is a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and known as one in this new genre, new world of young hip-hop scholars, one of the rising young stars in the world. He's right here. Johns Hopkins will be with us in a minute. You can join us here, 410-319-8888. You're told to be a rising star, Vats.
Well, no, I was just wondering why you would have on somebody in addition to me about hip-hop.
410-319-8888 is the number here. One of the questions we're wrestling with today, and it's on both the Facebook pages. Now, I want you, if you can go there and join the conversation, that would be great. What happened was that this morning I was as I was reading the papers and reading the news on the line, online, everywhere else, started seeing all the issues that we face here, the healthcare question. People started looking at healthcare in America and this new challenge to the report from Dartmouth that was the study that was the underpinning of President Obama's healthcare plan, where we say $700 billion, in Medicare costs being challenged by numbers of people saying, you can't say because things are cheaper in northern Minnesota, it fits Johns Hopkins University of Maryland. And it doesn't take into account who gets saved and who doesn't get saved. But it does take into account the bottom line of money. We have teacher layoffs. We have city and state workers being laid off. And none of the state governments and city governments around the country can answer the question other than laying people off. They really don't have a response to what we face, we're looking at the BP oil spill and environmental disasters that are happening around the country and around the globe. Do we really have a response to these things? And we don't seem to. So the question I posited to our three guests and posited to all of you and posited to the folks on our Facebook is the question of whether or not our political and economic system are capable of responding to what we face, that they do not have the tools in place to do it for numbers of reasons, which I will outline during the course of our conversation. I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation and give us your thoughts. I would start with Lester, but he's not here yet, so I'll start with y'all.
Well, I mean, when you talk about do we have the power to deal with our problems, I mean, this cuts such a wide swath. I mean, let's take a random problem, the problem of Iran. You know, do we have the ability to stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons? Well, if we have a president who believes in negotiation even when negotiation fails and doesn't want to take any strong positions against Iran, and if Iran then gets nuclear weapons, I guess you could come to the conclusion that there was nothing we could do to stop it. But on the other hand, if you had had a different president who was more aggressive
you're not answering the question, Vats, because what you're doing is giving a political point. I'm not talking about a political point here.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not, because I'm not saying I don't care if it was President Bush in office or President Obama or McCain or anybody else. The question is, no one really has a way of – I mean, that's even another issue of Iran, of how it really – short of trying to invade and get into another war, stopping another country from having nuclear weapons. The issue is the larger one. The issue is our political system capable of addressing – the myriad of issues that we face.
Well, the answer I'm trying to give you is yes. The answer I'm trying to give you is that if you had a different president with a different philosophy, if we had had a conservative president since Ronald Reagan, we might not have some of the problems that we have today.
But I don't think it's a matter of presidential power. I think it's a larger question, and the question I would also answer yes, because I believe that regulated capitalism is the best political economic system in the world to solve most of society's challenges. And now that's a big broad statement, because that means it's well regulated and that means capitalism thrives, so that you can't have unregulated capitalism, because that's a disaster, and you can't have powerful governments that are centralized running the economy. And I do think we have a good mix, but is it always the perfect mix? No, clearly not. But I think it's the best mix out there. And then it's up to us to try to refine both the regulation or political or governmental side as well as the economic side.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think we have a good mix. I think centralization has taken over. You know, if you look at healthcare, for example. I mean, if you agree that it is unacceptable to have anybody suffering and anybody without health care coverage, and if you believe that it's crucial to add 41 million people or whatever figure you have to health care coverage, you know, then you could say that there's no answer because you've got to spend the money. But in fact, this is a new concept in America that all problems must be solved. And if you're intent on solving all problems, you end up solving no problems. And so the fact is that it's silly to say, can we not solve problems? The answer is, who will bear the burden of the positions we take? And in a capitalistic society, you know, we don't believe in lowering the waves so that, you know, all ships are fine. You know, the fact is, we have a competitive society in which some people are going to benefit, some people are not going to benefit. But if you take away incentive and you ensure that all people get all things, then you lose incentive. You have a socialistic society.
You've taken this in a place I wasn't going to take it, but we can go there, and I'll take the role since Lester's not here yet. I mean, I think that capitalism can answer the questions,
can or cannot
cannot answer the questions, and will not answer the questions, because the bottom line here has to do with profit. Bottom line has to do with as much as you can accumulate and as much as you can sell, and has very little to do with the human question. Yes, I do think that societies have to have a balance, and the balance has to be somewhere between the marketplace, which is a very natural inkling in human culture. It's been in every culture on the planet, but so has the communal aspect been in every culture on the planet. And that the communal aspect of the culture is what is the underpinning where people don't fall through the cracks of a society, whether it's a village or a larger society, that you take care of people in a society and you allow people to sell their wares and do their work and create things and I think both those streams of thought are very vibrant in human society. The problem is, I think that we because that we have a society where I think our democracy is being diminished and the corporate power is growing, that we have less and less of a chance for the future because our voice means less and less in the society, less than it probably has in a generation.
Do you think the poor will always be with us?
I don't know. Yeah, to answer that question, I think that there can always be. I do not think poverty has to be with us. I do not think poverty has to be with us. No, I do not.
But in a competitive society, the only way to end poverty is by a real and metaphorical overall welfare system.
No, I don't think you have to have welfare. You can have a different kind of system. Do you think? You answer Vats's question for yourself. Do you think that's true? That we'll always have poverty?
Yes, I think we'll always have poverty.
Folks, do you think so? 410-319-8888.
It's a matter of degree.
And let's see what that degree means to people. 410-319-8888. Join us here. Your thoughts. Patrick from Johns Hopkins University.
Hello, Mark.
You're on the air. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Mark. Hi. I think a very interesting question. I think I was really struck by the answer of the first gentleman whose name I forget.
Richard Vats.
Yes. And that is a problem in America. I think that very simple questions like the one that you posited are often answered in filtered political terms as opposed to structural terms or factual terms. I think your question was very simple but evoked a political answer. And therein lies the problem in a democracy when you mix democracy and capitalism. Countries where there's a theocracy or countries where there is a benevolent dictatorship tend to seem more robust because they have this sense of purpose and they don't have to go through the sausage-making of our political process. So I think that if we carry on with the sort of divide that we've had in society and carry on with letting corporations sort of run our political decision-making process, we will simply go down like all the great civilizations that have come before us, the Greeks and the Romans, really from internal dynastic struggle, if you will. And so I thought it was very telling that a very simple question you asked was indeed that evoked a political answer which had very much a tangential reason or tangential logic with the question that you asked. So this is, I think, America's problem and part of our failure to confront many of the difficulties that we face.
Patrick, I think you're leaning towards where I was trying to kind of probe the question I'm trying to probe in this conversation. I think that there's a question that about, I don't care if it's capitalism or the social democratic societies of Europe or the communist societies that existed before the fall of the Soviet Union. None of them could address the issues because, A, of their complexity, and became out of control and can't – I mean – The democratic socialist parties that run governments in Europe can't answer the questions that the corporate conservative capitalism of America
what
can't
was,
answer.
What was Margaret Thatcher's great remark? The problem with socialism is soon you run out of other people's money.
I'm not, see, but you're doing it again, Vats.
Well, what am I doing again?
You're doing it. You can't get out of an ideological framework with any question that gets asked.
Well, that's,
you're
that's,
stuck in a mold.
Listen,
that's the problem
you
with
call
the country.
It, you call it stuck in a mold. I call it consistency.
No, that's the problem, I think, with America. That we are that the only way we address these things is in our narrow, blinded, ideological responses.
Well, that sounds like an ad hominem attack to me.
You like saying that word. You love ad hominem. One of your favorite things to say.
I think it's completely relevant. I mean, what we're talking about here is how to ensure that there is no poverty in America. And our answer has been since Ronald Reagan, spend. And the Margaret Thatcher quote is a very, very pertinent quote. The problem with socialism is that soon you run out of other people's money. I mean, you just can't.
Unless you think of government as our government and the money we're spending is our money. It's not someone else's money. The government is us.
Well, see, here's the problem.
I
think it is structural in the sense, and perhaps we need Lester here, but it's really a matter of paradigms, worldly paradigms, and that is, do I as a person believe that a central government can, in its brilliance, solve all of the world's problems, and therefore I, as a citizen, expect to be taken care of by my government and expect it to understand how to do everything for me? Or do I believe as an individual, and maybe this is where it's very American, that I'm personally responsible both to myself and to my neighbor and to my community, that I sit on like my local improvement association board because I care about what happens within my community, and I'm involved in the politics at some level. I don't mean, I'm not talking about Republican, Democrat, whatever, but I'm involved in the political life of the community. And I do think that over the past century, perhaps, people are less personally involved, whether it's in their church, in their community, in the politics, like the old Chappewa meetings. I have that name wrong.
Chautauqua.
Thank you. And we've given over more responsibility to the government, and we think it should take care of us. It can't. We're just a collection of people. There's no one magic savior who's going to be able to run any government of any complexity, of any nation that's large like ours, and figure out the best way to structure everything for a perfect outcome.
Well, let me open the phones. 410-319-8880. I'm going to read a Facebook from Darius. It's a tad long, but I'm going to read it. 410-319-8888. And Hassan, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
How you doing?
I would say that the way to end poverty is for us to get back to living the way our ancestors did, and that's living through allotted pieces of land, an agricultural society where you live off allotted pieces of land. Everybody is responsible for growing your own food, making your own clothing, and things like that. I think that something as simple as that could literally end poverty in America or any society.
Certainly eliminate the class system. I mean, we can move back to being a third world country.
I mean, think about it. If you think about,
I don't dismiss people's ideas like that, Bass. I mean, that's just really rude.
Can I disagree, Mark? Every time I disagree, you get upset.
But
I'm sorry.
He's suggesting that perhaps we've lost something.
Yeah, we're now an industrialized society.
Well, specialization has allowed us, or the control of our agriculture has allowed us to develop specializations. That is, we're not all involved in agriculture, so some people can make clothes, some people can, you know, tinker. Some people can build bridges. That's the benefit of the specialization. The disadvantage is that we all forget that we're, as the caller says, you know, we're no longer taking care of ourselves in terms of our own livelihood, about making the food that we eat and the clothes that we wear. We're very dependent.
Let me read this piece from Darius, and we'll go to Chris in Glen Burnie, who's the next caller up. And number is 410-319-8888. Let me find this piece. He writes, I wrote at the top here. This morning, reading the news about health care, the BP spill, teacher layoffs, and education funding cuts, and so on, and on and on and on, I began to question whether our political and economic systems had the capability to respond to really fix any of this. We are driven by profit corporations, the bottom line. The human factor seems to be not to be a variable. What do you think? And people were all over the map, and I will read this one first. Darius writes in, to the contrary, the human factor is a variable. It's just negligible in the face of corporate power and the effects of capitalism. But both of those forces are as a direct result of the human trait most commonly referred to as greed. Even the most innocuous form, selfish behavior, pervades society and increases in direct proportion with the availability of resources like food and shelter. Why should we be surprised by any of the events we've seen in the last 8 to 10 years? Everyone is looking more and more at the short term because we're all afraid of the long term. At one extreme, the fear is the world will end in 2012. At the other extreme, the fear, even among those extremely wealthy, is that nobody really knows if and when it will end, and only that without solutions that appear truly sustainable, it can't last forever. So it's, quote, hey, I'm going to get mine now, end quote. Either way, it snowballs into the predicament we're in now. I liken it to the selfish behavior by drivers. We see on the road, we see recurring bases on the highway, people whose destination is to enter traffic from an on-ramp lane clearly see the traffic is backed up, yet they speed past everyone in a lane destined to merge, only to find the merge lane eventually disappears. What they have accomplished by getting stuck there rather than being a bit more patient, leaving some space and merging gradually, would their patience influence others to also be patient and even perhaps allow them into a larger, slower flow of traffic? Hard to say. Logic says conservation only works if everyone thinks about it in similar ways, looking beyond themselves to see a more comprehensive solution. Short of a dream such as that, perhaps the only other way to stem the tide of destruction that's being waged against the planet is population control, a taboo subject, but one which could directly affect the depletion of the existing resources.
What a profoundly false analogy. I mean, to talk about competition in a capitalistic world as analogous to a single car driver who benefits himself and only himself by his irresponsible driving is I don't find it's a good analogy.
I think it's a pretty good analogy.
Well, I think it's horrendous.
To the two of you.
I think it fits.
Okay, let me say this. I first of all, I don't think it helps us further the conversation by casting this evil corporate capitalistic attitude. It's just part of the dialogue that's developed, or lack of dialogue, that pits one side against the other, and they're just screaming at each other from the left and the right, and nobody is left in the middle with me. But no, and it doesn't help, because corporations are made up of people. Many people have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So when I look at my fellow human beings, I find that, yes, they are interested in many times furthering themselves. And sometimes it seems like they are self-centered, but they're also very interested in leaving the world a better place for their children. I think human beings can hold two different, almost countervailing things and motivations at the same time. And in the mix, we get the little mess that we have that's called life.
Mary Washington, who is an activist in town, and I think is also running for the House of Delegates, is joining us. Mary, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm enjoying this discussion. I wish I had more time to be with you.
Me too. So tell me your thoughts what you've heard so far.
Well, the question of can we end poverty, yes, we can. And we have to think of different types of things. Can we end the hunger in our communities? I think we're sort of having this conversation at this really high level. And again, I'm, you know, a fellow academic by training, or I should say I'm a recovering academic. I went to Hopkins. I'm a sociologist. And in my work, I think it's really useful for us in terms of analyzing the problems, to look at a large view, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. But I think ultimately when we're thinking about actual the solutions, we have to think about, as you say, families, as individuals. So can we in Baltimore City or in Maryland do something to reduce hunger? Can we do something to reduce disease? Can we do something to improve our natural environments? Absolutely. And I don't think there's any room, actually, for us to say otherwise. So I think if we can figure out, and then I'll flip it back to the theoretical, how do we accommodate that from a theoretical perspective? How do we link theory, you know, to actual practice and organizing on a local level? I mean, folks used to talk about, you know, local solutions to global problems, and we've seen gotten away from that.
Now, you were talking a bit about that.
Me?
Yes.
About global solutions to local problems?
You were talking about starting from the bottom up.
Yes.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
Starting in your community.
Yep.
Yes, totally.
But yeah, that's not a government-centered.
No, that's not a government-centered solution.
No.
Right. That's a big issue, you know, the extent to which you have government-centered solutions and you eliminate competition.
Mary, go ahead.
I guess what I find interesting is sort of insisting, and I think I'm going to have to agree with Mark's critique. So I don't know you, so I can't really say it ad hominem. But
go ahead.
But I think we keep sort of going back to, you know, this sort of the government. And I think Mark's comment that the government is us, you know, we are, I'm sort of remembering something about the walrus or something, but, you know, we really are, you know, the government. We really are the people who are tasked with taking care of each other. And I think if we keep sort of reflectively going back saying, oh, that's the government, or, you know, that's some kind of anarchy. And I think, you know, as the other guest said, that we really need to look very much in that middle space and that middle path. And I'm really interested in listening to, you know, the rest of the discussion, think about how do we theoretically and structurally, without zooming all the way back to, you know, national governments, you know, how do we look at that?
Professor Washington, may I ask you a question?
On the letter. Yeah.
What do you think about income redistribution?
So if I make that a practical, are you talking about should people get tax credits for investing in certain types of social programs?
I'm saying, do you think that taxing should be so severe that very few people make more than anybody else?
No, I actually don't.
I'm relieved to hear that.
Again, but what I think happens when you make that kind of argument and you're talking with a group of people, you know, who perhaps make a lot of money, but if we had a different sort of argument about, hey, what can we do to reduce poverty and hunger in our communities? And are you willing to have some portion of what you make this year go towards that?
That's
a very different type of discussion.
Not only do I believe in charity, but I
not
think
charity though.
Pardon me?
I don't think we're
it's
talking
not
about charity.
Well,
but
it's actually in all of our interests that we reduce disease, that we reduce.
I believe in philanthropy. I believe in people giving their money, and people do this. As a matter of fact, I think, I don't have the statistics because I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but I think Americans are statistically the most generous people in the world.
But is there a balance that we can strike here in the world between what we're all talking about here? Maybe in the way our conversation is going, the kind of the ideological sense is that it's impossible. That on the one hand, doing things from the bottom up and changing things. I'm thinking about not necessarily just community work, but what's going on in Cleveland right now, which is hundreds of people in a project in Cleveland have created a cooperative business that got the major hospitals and universities to sign on to, so that workers are now making a living at a business they own, hundreds of men and women together in a laundry, a solar company, and a third company that I'm blocking on what it is. But they're doing that. So that's bubbling up from the bottom. But the other part is maybe instead of thinking about government doing everything, government has certain responsibilities. Government built the highways. Government can build the internet highway.
They fight our
and
wars.
Own it rather than letting it be owned by a few companies like Verizon and a few others and let the marketplace decide from there. If government provides health care as a pass-through, let the marketplace take it from there. But it's that there's something that we can do as a society that we,
Yeah, but healthcare is just a perfect example of too much government intrusion. I mean, this unbelievably
ensuring that everybody can have
a
doctor.
I have a question. It's been interesting. Again, the disaster that we're having now in the golf course, in the Gulf. And, you know, folks who have all of their careers talked about, you know, you don't want government to intrude. We don't want government to intrude. But when, you know, there's oil sort of spilling and no one can control it, or if there's some kind of natural disaster and no one can control it, all of a sudden, everybody's very much interested in what the government should do.
I agree with you, Mary, in the sense that I think that the function of government is limited about six things, a half dozen things. One, of course, is national defense. Another is public health.
Right.
Another is the system of law, which is very important. And in fact, I think that the problem with this particular administration, the past administration, and probably the one before that, is that they have neglected their duty in terms of regulation. We wouldn't have had the Wall Street fiasco if the Fed had been on top of what was happening. They knew what was happening. They just let it happen. And we don't need new regulations to have prevented that. They just had to use the regulations that were in place. The same thing with BP. If they had regulated that correctly, if they had made those people go through the safety checks and have those backup wells, which they should have had from the very beginning because that's protocol, then we wouldn't be having this disaster. It's a failure of government to regulate.
Mary, then Lester Spence just called. I want to get him in the conversation. Yeah. Mary, finish what you were saying.
Yeah, I just want to, because I'm sorry I have to go, but I think that what I really like us to wrestle with is we have a blended model already, folks. Mm-hmm. We already have one. So we don't have, you know, this sort of, I think, time nor leisure to sort of say, you know, what happens if there's no government? What happens if it's all government? And when we have each other and we have systems where government does some things, we wish they would do it well. We wish that, as you would say, we would execute and use the laws and policies that are on the books. There are also some creative experiments that are being done in other countries, in other cities. What can we in Baltimore? I want to bring it back. We're living in Baltimore. Bring it back to Maryland. And maybe it might not seem so insurmountable if we honestly, and again, and not some sort of Pollyanna, you know, wishful thinking, but very strategically, what can we do to reduce poverty? What can we do to reduce sickness? What can we do to make sure that everybody who's part of our city is able to live a happy and healthy life? And I'll continue to drive and listen. But
Mary,
Mark,
thanks so much.
Always, you have great topics, and I enjoy listening to both of your guests, and thank you.
Good to have you with us for a minute. Mary Washington, who is running for the House of Delegates in the 43rd District. 410-319-8888's number. Lester, you're with us. Lester Spence.
Hey, I sincerely apologize for not being able to be there with you guys and stepping in late. I just wanted to run off a couple of quick points.
You've been listening, though, right?
Yeah, I've been listening.
Go ahead. Good.
I really appreciate the conservative point of view, but the challenge here is that it's empirically wrong on almost every level, right? I mean, so it's not just empirically wrong. There's a lot of humanity that's left out. So what your conservative brother, what he doesn't say when he talks about health care, that in a capitalist system in that we have some winners and losers. When we're talking about health care, what that means is some people live and some people die, right? And if we're talking about bringing humanity into government, most people would say that how much money you make shouldn't necessarily affect whether you live or die from something, from a common set of diseases, right? Secondly, we know that there are a number of cases in which government actually does work, right? So we know it works, that that systems of government that actually control health care, right? They tend to provide better health outcomes for everybody than systems of government where health care is left up for private business. Right, so we know government works. So in some ways, I'm really I'm saying over again what your last caller said. But, and this is where you come in, Mark, the challenge is that government doesn't always work. So in those cases where government doesn't always work, we have to create institutions because corporations are more than just aggregations of people. We have to create institutions that allow the people rather than private forces to create new spaces, and that's where the co-ops come in.
Let me go to the phones. Let you come right back, Rick, and as well, Anne. About to call you Mary. Anne, is Mary's not in your name at all? Is it
Anne Marie?
I thought knew. I had a feeling. 410-319-8888. Chris and Glenn Burney are on the air.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi, Chris. Welcome.
How you doing?
Your question is can we end poverty or do we have to live with poverty? And I think the answer to it is really, if you, whether or not you believe in the Bible, it's almost like this, the story of biting the apple, the genie's out of the bottle, man's thirst for more and more and more. Obviously, we can live without poverty. We did it initially. Where basically the community provided for all within the community. And it wasn't so much a welfare program, it was just people taking care of people. But again, now that the genie's out of the Bible, out of the bottle, man is not going to go backwards. We would have to regress almost to infancy, to where kids, you know, you wonder how to stop racism. All kids will play with kids. They'll look at each other and know the differences, but then they say, okay, at the end of the day, let's just play. But you can't go back. So that's the main problem, is that we can exist without poverty, but the thing is, I don't think we can get back to that place to where that would be a possibility.
Let's talk about that for a minute. And I'm going to read Alexis Smith's comment, then I'll ask all three of you to comment for this. Alexis writes in on Facebook, I must agree that our systems are not built to respond. Our systems are manipulated to create products, but make them seem scarce, to drive up prices, to foster competition and not collaboration, and to ensure there will always be have-nots. He seems that when you suggest extending oneself to a fellow human being, it's a laughable proposition. The society doesn't take seriously the motive of love, one another, or even just to be good to one another. It's disheartening, but I do maintain that faith and keep trying in my own little ways. Facebook's amazing when it has changed our existence. Is it not?
And it wasn't created by the government.
No, but the internet that it's on was.
Kind of.
No, it was.
Yeah, the DARPA system.
The DOD.
Well, remember what I said? A function of government is national defense. That was the DARPA
But it
system.
Was also function of government is to create a space for people to work out and from, which is what, without the government, there would be no internet. Would not have been an internet.
True. It started, though, as national defense.
However it began, you know. Okay. When the polio vaccine was created, the man who created it made no profit on it. He did it for humanity, for profit.
They understand that there wasn't the competition. There wasn't one person who came up with a polio vaccine. If he hadn't done it, we'd still be today without a polio vaccine. There was tremendous competition at that time to acquire polio vaccine. He was the first, right.
But we were looking at people who were developing things not for corporations, but were developing them for humanity, which is a big difference.
Yeah, but it was true. But you could argue
that. Well, that is true. The function of, say, Johns Hopkins is everything for humanity, especially out of the medical research and the medical school. And
it is competition.
To get there.
I'm sorry. Finish what you're saying.
Real quick.
Lester, go ahead. And then over to Richard.
Real quick, so the discussion about poverty, what we have to realize is two real simple things. One is wealth inequality changes over time as a response to government policy. That is, you know, the level, the difference between the haves and have-nots is not a constant. It's not something that randomly goes up and down. It changes in response to government policy. So we can reduce it. And in reducing it, we can actually create a better society. That's the first thing. The second is, similar to wealth inequality, the poverty rate goes up and down in response to government policy. The poverty rate isn't something that remains constant over time, and nor is it something that fluctuates randomly. It changes. We know what changes it. So will poverty always be with us? And as an aside, the conservative actually brought the quote up. He's misreading the Bible when he uses that, although, to be fair, a lot of people do. But we know poverty can actually – there are countries that do a very good job dealing with poverty. We are not one of them. We can do a much better job that will require us to deal with race, among other things. But we shouldn't act like poverty is just something that kind of is natural, or we don't really know how it works or what to do about it. We do.
I think his philosophy and my philosophy are in such contradiction because he believes that, you know, when you lower the tide, you raise all ships, and I believe that when you lower the tide, you lower all ships. But let me just make a point about, you know, we can't talk about things like healthcare reform out of the context of who benefits and who loses. One of the most significant aspects, there are a couple of very significant aspects of healthcare that strike me every time I talk about it, and I don't consider myself an expert on healthcare, but the lack of tort reform, a tremendously consequential component of the cost of healthcare. Nothing is done about tort reform. And Mark, I know that you and I disagree on this 100%. But the, you know, a lot of people don't realize the tremendous expense we have for psychiatric care in our healthcare, which has nothing.
Okay, let's not go into the side here. Well, with the psychiatric care.
But my point is the irrelevance of components of healthcare to satisfy some people's ideological agenda cost tremendous amounts of money.
That you're taking
Mark,
it off to
real quick.
To another world here.
I disagree.
Let me jump in real quick, Mark. Because I know my brother to the right and my sister to the center have had since like 5:15, and I'm jumping in late. I understand that. But really quick, there is no data, no empirical data. So I'm not only on the left, I'm a social scientist. I study this for a living. There is no empirical data that shows that changing tort reform would do anything more than modify costs by like 3 or 4%. So when you talk about tremendous costs, there is no data to support that. So that's a challenge that we have where it's really difficult to deal with claims because some of the people who are involved in the fight aren't necessarily dealing with data. They're not dealing with a full deck.
You cannot estimate how changes in tort reform will affect health care costs because nobody knows.
But no, of course you can. That's just like poverty.
But even 3 to 4 – okay, we're sort of getting –
Bogged down,
but even 3 to 4% is a lot, even if it's not huge. I think this is all a little bit here, a little bit there makes a big difference. And I'm going to be in the center again here for a little bit, but I think that I agree with Mary Washington. We have a blended system. We might as well, you know, accept it. We're not going to abolish government. I don't quite agree with the conservatives that it should be tiny and small. It's necessary. I don't agree with the left liberal side that says that it should be larger and be a part of every part of our lives. I do think it has certain functions and it should be held accountable for those functions. And right now, government, and by the way, nor is corporate America being held accountable for the actions that they're doing. And it is the function of government to hold corporate America accountable.
That requires it to be bigger.
No, it doesn't. It requires it to do its job. All it required is one single inspector to go out to to look at that station that blew up in the Gulf. All it required was the Fed to – all of those Fed people already to – cut down on the securitization of mortgages. I mean, it does not require it to be bigger. But, it requires people to do their jobs.
It's one of the problems in that in what we face, why we can't put our hands around it, is because there's this revolving door between in that agency that was supposed to monitor the mm-hmm. oil wells
yeah. mm-hmm.
and with the Fed. Yeah. It's a revolving door between Wall Street and the security agencies. It's a revolving door between the oil industry and mining industry and,
mm-hmm. and the airline industry and the FAA and it has to be fixed.
Well, that's a component of the problem. I agree with. Yeah, absolutely. We can't get away from that.
No, we can get away from that. We don't have the political will to get away from.
Well,
that.
Yeah, but
I thought President Obama actually started down that line. I was really happy to see him sort of put constraints on how quickly you could go from lobbying into government yeah. and back from government into yeah. lobbying. Well, even if they're small.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not a sea change.
Let me ask our listeners to join us again before we have to break it. 410-319-8888. Elise, you're on the air. Hi, Elise, you there?
Maybe we lost her.
Did we lose Elise? I think we'll lose our callers because...
Hello?
Elise, you there? You are, love. Go ahead.
Yes,
you're on the air.
Hi.
Welcome.
I hate to get back to, hate going back and forth, but I think, like what one of your guests said earlier, that what's wrong with our country now is the, capitalism in this country. It's inherently wrong, and you have to look at the history of it in this particular country. It has not worked. You've had a system where the haves always took advantage of the have-nots. That's what our country is, fundamentally based on, and with that, We are promoting ideology that you know, regular average Joe could make it and be a millionaire when a lot of times that's pure luck and chance. That's not the reality of a lot of people, because you have a small handful of people in this country controlling, you know, pretty much all of the wealth. Now, how is that, you know, fair in this society? So that's, you know, pretty much all that I have to say.
At least I couldn't disagree with you more. Yeah, look at President Obama. He's an average Joe. He becomes president of the most powerful country in the world. President Clinton, he was born in a little backward city in Arkansas. President Reagan was born in the Midwest in a tiny little podunk town. This is a land, I mean, we have lots of ills, but this is a land of opportunity, and people can really make of themselves what they want to.
I'm sorry, Batston Lester.
Well, I was just going to say parenthetically, Mark, forgive me, but I've never been on your show in which I agreed with another person you had at the table. I'm very happy to have had this experience. This is literally the first time in all the years I've been on your show I think you've ever had a conservative. What passes for conservative for Mark's show anyway. Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
It's a pleasure.
Okay. I'm going to pull some tapes up and show you. Go ahead, Lester.
It's a pleasure, though.
And it's really funny. It's really, really funny. What Obama shows you is you basically have to stuff yourself through the eye of the needle. Why exactly would you use the first African-American president and what, how many hundreds of years? Right? How many hundreds of years did it take us to get one black president? And we're using that as the example of opportunity for everybody?
No, I use President Clinton and President Reagan also.
Examples abound, although we haven't had a Jewish president yet.
How much is Clinton worth now, Bill Clinton?
How much was he worth when he was born is the question.
How much is he worth now?
Well, probably less than President Obama.
Probably not.
Well, with his, those best-selling
more
books?
Soon, maybe more soon on Gore.
No, no, that's how I get into it. Pretty much he's worth more, but everything I've read says that President Clinton at this point is worth a great deal of money. I mean, he's a huge amount of money, just like Al Gore. They've made tons of money. Yeah. But what's your point, Lester?
So my point is, well, two things. One is that it's very, very difficult to actually ascend to the position. So we do have individuals who are able to come from little to nothing to make something of themselves. Obama is definitely one of them. But these people are exceptions rather than the rules. That's the first thing. The second thing is using the president as an example of opportunity is inherently problematic in as much as all the presidents are paid, right? And when they make policies, they make policies that may tilt in this context a little bit to the left, but most of their policies support and reproduce wealth. Now, the conservatives in the panel, the conservative of us, will probably agree with that. Like, wow, that's the best way for society to succeed. But for those of us who actually understand that human capital can be found everywhere, even in the ghettos of Detroit, that doesn't make sense to us. Why would we create policies that would benefit the wealthy as opposed to finding creating policies that can find human capital wherever it resides?
Let me just say, folks, that we have to wrap the discussion up, but I'd like to come back and do this and maybe just question, is capitalism no capitalism in the future of the world? Is that what we need? And what is it? If not, then what is it we need? And Rich Kratz,
I'll just say very quickly, if we go by the European model, you know, we're headed towards socialism, and
okay. Well, I don't want to end there. That's not what I want to end this.
Okay. But Rick, I always misunderstand you tonight.
No.
I've never. Good. What do you want to ask?
What I'm saying is that what I think that's the conversation I want to kind of leap off into for the next conversation.
Okay.
I want you in on that conversation.
Thank you,
Rick. That's always.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just was just saying how great it is to see you all the time.
It's great to see you too. I apologize for misunderstanding you.
Ann McCarthy, always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Same here,
you're
Mark.
The great. And Lester Spence, I love you, man. Good to have you with us.
Love you too, man. I'll be back.
And we'll all come back. And we're going to take a short break and meet the Reverend Adam Hamilton. This should be a very interesting conversation. I want you to stay with us for that. Don't go away, please. On the way out, let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its seven branches or go to MECU.com for more information. Be right back.